Hi, welcome to Outrageous, a bi-weekly podcast where we talk about media, race, culture, politics, and everything in between. Yet again, I'm joined by my two very best friends, Trisha in LA.
Hello.
And Jason in DC.
What's up?
Hey guys, what's going on?
Enjoying my white wine spritzer.
Yes.
You are.
Yeah, Trisha has decided to drink. We've driven her completely off the edge. And in order to do these, she must be at least somewhat buzzed. So any opinions you might hear are brought to you by White Wine Spritzers, our first sponsor for the evening.
I do want to throw out, I wonder whether we need some kind of an approval process, Chris, for what you post in terms of the text you put with these. Because on the last one, first you said we were all bi, which was a little startling to me.
Bi-weekly. We're bi-weekly.
Right. Yeah, but you made your little joke about it, and that's great. And then you said, when you were talking about my topic, you said, Jason wants prostitution legalized by this weekend, preferably, or something like that.
It's like, oh, that's true.
It's funny. It was funny.
It is funny. Could give some people the wrong impression. But come on.
First off, anyone's going to get the wrong impression. It's for all the crazy, super idealistic stuff that you're saying every time we record. So if anyone's going to get a wrong impression, it's going to be from that. Does anyone do anything super interesting today?
No.
No, actually.
That's really sad. I'm going to cut that out.
Oh, you know what? That's great.
Other people are doing really interesting things right now. We're recording a podcast.
I had to go out to Long Island for work. I'm from Long Island. I grew up there.
I was
going to
say, is that really interesting? I never think of Long Island as really interesting.
It's actually a little depressing. So... I don't often go to Long Island.
Anybody
really.
Do anything depressing today?
Yeah, I went all the way out to Amityville because I had a meeting out there, and I was by the Sunrise Mall, so I thought I would swing by because I spent a lot of time at the Sunrise Mall when I was like a teenager, like doing whatever teenagers are doing in a mall. Which, looking back, talk about people with no disposable income in like some economic like shopping center. But anyway, I went back. And it was, like, super depressing. First of all, malls are not what they were 20, 25 years ago.
No.
Second of all, it was the middle of the day, so there was nobody in there. And everything just had, like, this general air of disarray and decay. It was super depressing. So
that vignette. Oof.
Yeah, everyone deal with that.
That anecdote needed to stop immediately.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. I feel really inspired.
There was something very Cormac McCarthy about the whole thing. It felt like a chapter out of the road. It was completely bleak. It was so bleak and depressing. So, look, neither of you did anything interesting lately. I'm just saying, that's what I did today.
Thank you for sharing.
So... let's all get hobbies. All right. Let's not waste any more time. So we have three topics that we are going to discuss. Each of us spent a lot of time thinking about it. And this week, I'm going to go first because I never go first. You ever notice that? I usually pick on one of you two.
Yes, you do.
Okay, well, seems like you two had a conversation about it and you're mad. So I wanted to talk about the North Carolina bathroom bills, HB2, and I wanted to have a more general conversation about what's going on with trans rights right now, in the sense that it seems to me that HB2, this idea that transgender people have to use the bathroom of the sex they were assigned at birth, or else, I guess, it's really not clear to me what will happen, what the or else is. And that's it. It has some other provisions in there, but that's generally the heft of the bill and the thing that made it super famous. Over the past couple of weeks now, we've had situations where businesses have been targeted because they are saying that they are inclusive and people can use the bathroom they want. One such business that's been targeted has been Target. I heard that. Target's been targeted. And so the situation that's being created in Target and other businesses is that now you have men who, if they spot a masculine-looking woman going into the bathroom, they will charge into the women's bathroom to confront that person. And several times it has been just really butch lesbians who are going to the bathroom. But it seemed to me that for a bill that purported to address a problem, which reportedly has never actually happened,
right,
is now creating that self-same problem of having men running into bathrooms and accosting women. Women. Anyway, this is really terrible. But what's going on in the country right now? Where do you guys think we're at with this? Why is this happening now? Why are we passing legislation for problems that don't actually exist? I mean, North Carolina, a bill legislating against unicorns and dragons would have been as effective in North Carolina, solving a problem that doesn't exist. So what's going on with this hysteria, Trish?
I wasn't even aware of this as a problem, which is clearly
which
your point. I wasn't aware there was a bathroom issue.
Saying there wasn't one.
I hadn't even, you know what, it hadn't even occurred to me because it's rare for you to even go into a bathroom and see the person in the bathroom with you. I mean, the only time you see them is when you're washing your hand to leave, especially in a women's bathroom. We're not opening, you know, they're not free. They're not freewheeling like that. So I've rarely attended to the bathroom. This is the most I've had to think about a bathroom. So I'm thinking to myself that the bathroom issue some group must have gotten together and said this is the most practical way for us to approach trans people and handling them inside and making them understand that they're not welcome in our society. Some group must have said, okay, what's the best way for us to tackle this issue? You know what's really scary? The idea that I might be sharing a bathroom with someone that might not have been born with a penis. I don't know. I mean, I'm literally really confused by it. I have very little to offer about why this is coming up. It's just not a part of my psyche. Jason, can you help me? I'm shocked by it, really.
I think there are people who have a mentality, and this has been the case for a long time, that homosexuality is a threat to the well-being of children, right? We had this fight over whether same-sex couples should be able to marry. And I think a big part of why people have been so against it is that there is a significant group of people in our country who feel like, well, if same-sex couples can marry, then my kid may end up being gay and wanting to marry. It's like we shouldn't have gay teachers because what if they teach our kids to be gay? I think there are people who actually think like that. I mean,
you
I think
have
it's
the idea
absurd.
How hard it is to be gay. You can't be taught. Let me tell you.
I know it's one of those things where like it's yeah. But anyway, but so that battle's been lost, right? I mean, it's gotten to the Supreme Court and it's been lost. Like same-sex couples can marry. I mean, not everywhere, but the momentum is definitely there, right? So I feel like you have now this group of people that's on the defensive, and they're trying to figure out like where can they put their stake in the ground. Okay, so where's the next place? And so now I think, and I do think people really believe this, even though I think there's no evidence to support it, that like, well, the children are in danger in the bathroom, because if we let trans people in the bathroom, then our kids can get molested and our young women can get molested and that kind of thing. So I really think it's that same, it's people who are afraid of difference, people who see difference as contagion, and there's got to be something done to stop the contagion. I think that's where it's coming from. Again, I think it's absolutely absurd, but I think that's what it is.
Why can't people name the thing that they're upset about? Because not for nothing, but okay, so if we're afraid of men going to the women's bathroom and assaulting little girls, what about mothers who are sending their sons into the men's bathroom, right? Or taking their kids to a Catholic church? You know what I mean? Like, there's all sorts of situations where boys can be molested by men and they're in the same space with them all the time. So clearly we're not really worried about that, right? So I just don't know why people can't name the thing. If you want to make new Jim Crow laws in 2016, but you want to target trans people, why don't you just say that? I mean, you're not going to get away with it, just like they're not going to get away with this. The federal government can't let this stand.
Well, the weird thing about it is also it's highly impractical to even police that.
Yeah, it's impossible.
Like, as we're seeing now, I mean, men like, are you, the bathroom. Do you have a vagina? Show it to me!
Well, I mean, is this like a stage one thing now where you, this is like a step in the direction to having like an official ID, so that now instead of walking around with your birth certificate, you now have an ID card that says born female. So then you can go into bathrooms. You got to make sure you put it around your neck, and then you swipe and it says official male, officially female. And you, I just, the practicality of actually making sure that this law is well executed seems tremendously time consuming. And I feel very sorry for the cop that has to make sure that this happens, because I'm completely confused about why this needs to get done. But, you know, I mean, I guess Jason is right. I guess people really feel, maybe they feel as if there's an onslaught against them, that their rights are being trampled.
I definitely think that's the case, yeah.
So this is, and back is attacking trans people, and like you said, Trisha, reminding them that they're unwelcome in our society.
Yeah, I mean, in the most sort of basic and uncomfortable way, right? It's like, let's take away this thing that is supposed to be sort of seamless. I feel a need to go to the bathroom, I comfortably go to the bathroom. I mean, they've really taken away the space that you should be so comfortable. You know, it's not about going to a restaurant, it's not about spending money, it's not about anything. It's about basically a bodily function. I just don't even, and it actually, I think the law passed within, what did I read, 10 hours? So it was clearly something that everybody was happy to do.
Well, we should remember that the North Carolina legislature.
Yes.
You know, the story is out there that it's been completely recomposed. You know, basically a single funder has made that an extreme right. I mean, that legislature is to the right of a lot of the cities, right? I mean, Charlotte was trying to be progressive on this issue, and basically, what I find amazing about the laws, it's not just. I mean, it claims to be protecting, but it's not allowing cities to. It's like a states' right argument, but like it's completely trampling on the rights of cities to do things differently. It's like such an ironic situation. What I'm wondering, and I almost hesitate to say it, but how long will it take before someone stages an incident that seems to support why laws like this are needed?
Oh, it's funny you say that because across my feed this morning, I saw there was something about man pretends to be transgender to go into a women's bathroom. The thing is that it wasn't well sourced. It was one article, and it was at some website I'd never heard of. But I'm sure that that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to put it out there to manufacture the fear after to stoke the fear after they've passed this law to sort of justify, well, this is why we had to do it, because it's actually happening. But I mean, it's not happening. So we agree that it's not happening. We know that for a fact. So what's the next step? Loretta Lynch, when she came out, the Attorney General of the United States, when she came out announcing that the federal government would be suing North Carolina because they violate federal anti-discrimination acts, she referenced the idea that in our past we have tried to institute really discriminatory laws after we make a giant social push forward. So she agrees with you, Jason. Like, after the Emancipation Proclamation, people passed Jim Crow laws. And after Brown versus Board of Education, they passed other laws to limit educational access for blacks. So now here we are, after gay marriage has passed, it is the last gasp of bigotry. Like, let's make this happen. But why does this keep happening? One. And how come we haven't learned our lesson from now?
Like, well, I don't know. And why it keeps happening? I mean, because it is.
Well,
maybe
the second part more. The second part more. How is it still a conversation in 2016? We're so clear about what's happening, yet we can't seem to talk about it. As you both know, I prefer my bigotry where I can see it. And so I don't want to have a discussion about bathrooms. I want to have a discussion about trans people being accepted in society. Or is that too big of a conversation to have for the yokels who support this sort of stuff?
Well, I think that there is a substantial evangelical community, and I don't know if evangelical is the best word, because I definitely think this goes across racial lines in many cases. But there's a Christian community in our country, not all Christians, but there is a community that does see this as a battle, and they feel like it needs to be publicly stated that homosexuality is sinful and wrong, that marriage is between a man and a woman, which we've heard a former president say and advocate for a constitutional amendment saying as much. And as long as we have people who practice their Christianity as not judge not lest ye shall be judged, but it's my job to enforce a theocracy on everybody else in the country, I don't see it going away. This, like gay marriage, this may, the Supreme Court and the federal government may succeed in kind of pushing the dominoes over on this, but I'm sure they're going to find another, I don't know, I think these battles are going to go on and on. I don't see an end to it because there are people, I've heard it directly in churches, preachers saying, like, this is an attack on us. And that's how some people really feel about it. And as long as some people really feel that way about it, I don't think the conflict's going away.
You know, this is the thing I don't understand about that, because I have often thought of churches as a space where you're not supposed to be of the world, right? So executing...
What do you mean?
Well, you know, on some level, when I was growing up, my sense of Christians were that they were very different from other people in our community. They were operating under their own rules. They had a direct dial to God, and they were following the rules of the Bible. And so I don't understand why it doesn't play out that way. Like, why do you have to police my behavior? I thought the role of your church and your relationship with your church is to police your own behavior, police your own Christian community. This extrapolating and pushing of things outward, I just don't get that. I mean, it's between you and your God. I mean, does God really care if you're sharing a bathroom with a trans person? I mean, go in, do your business, and leave. To me, this idea of kind of like changing the world, I mean, that's where I don't get that. Like, that's where I feel as if we live in a space where we're going to all have to participate and engage in life with people who are going to have very different opinions from us. Why does your Christian beliefs trump my own sort of atheistic beliefs, if there's such a thing? Well, I don't understand why we can't do that.
That's very progressive of you.
It's not even progressive. I'm just saying.
But in this country, it is. In this country, it is.
Because what you're trying to say is that people can live side by side with people who are different from them. But that idea is new. You know, that idea is new. I mean, after all, this country was founded by people who believed quite the opposite. They had, or the people in Europe had religious ideas that were differed from theirs, and they just up and frickin' left, and they came over to build a world that conformed with their worldview.
Right? No, but not a Christian nation. This was not a Christian nation. I believe when folks were crafting the Constitution, they had very, very specific.
They fought to have it in there, and people fought to take it out.
Exactly. That was a really clear battle line for a lot of people, that we're not going to have religious sentiments in
the
Constitution.
Well, it wasn't, but it's not that clear, you know? I'm in many a courtroom during the week, and right behind the judge's head it says, "In God we trust." Like, it's on our money. So, I don't know. I see what you're saying.
There's always been tension. But... I mean, I think what you two are now illustrating, there's always been tension around this. I do think this point in time, I mean, when I look at the whole world right now, you know, I don't think
Where
so
are you
much.
Standing?
Where are you
Sorry,
standing?
Go ahead.
When I look at what's going on around the world now, you know, to me, it's not conflict between ultimately Shiites and Sunnis, or Christians and Muslims, or Jews and Muslims. It's really it's a conflict between religious fundamentalists and people who aren't religious fundamentalists. And what you're articulating, the way I would say it, Tricia, is that there are Christians who are not religious fundamentalists who, you know, believe that their religion teaches them to act in a certain way, but don't believe that their religion teaches them to try to force other people to act in that way. But then religious fundamentalists do, and that arguably is a growing group of people. Again, you know, not just Christian, Muslim and Jewish and Hindu. So I have no answers here. I think this is like the big conflict all around the world, is like how, and it's hard because religious fundamentalism is so sure of itself that it's very hard to argue with. I mean, people who are religious fundamentalists, there's no rationalizing, and I don't know where it's going.
Well, let me ask you this. I'm going to shift the topic a little bit as we take it out. I think that religious fundamentalism will become more fervent as we go on. Like, these ideas are going to become wilder and more extreme but I also feel like there'll be fewer adherents to it over time. Would you agree with that?
I hope you're right. I don't know.
I mean, I'm assuming that the best way for this to play out, which is not the best way, but is that we will have some sort of a holy war where we're just explicitly about religion. I mean,
sounds great.
Let's go back to the Crusades. I don't want to, but maybe at this point in time, what you have to have is a kind of conflagration, and then people just simply scatter and say absolutely no more. And you end up with a kind of generally, what's the word when it's a community that's not based on religion? What is that term?
Super cool. I don't know.
Secular.
Secular. You know, where a sort of secularity arises. And people have just said, you know what? You do you. Let's have sort of general laws that we all agree to, because what we've just done has been a disaster, and we've killed thousands or millions of people, and there's no reason for us to go down that road. I can't imagine that this won't have a violent end. That's my sense of it.
I think.
God damn it, Trisha.
What else can we do?
I'm not sure. So what you touched on something that I actually think is really important, that I think so much of this has to do with sense of belonging. And, you know, we've had previous conversations about deliberate communities and that kind of thing. And I think, you know, in our world, so much interaction is digital and short. And so where do you feel that you belong? And if you're going to go online and find a place to belong, you're going to find quick talking points. So part of the answer, this requires work, but like, and it sounds very basic, but like, we need to create communities that embrace people and that people feel embraced, that aren't based in religious fundamentalism. Because the thing about religious fundamentalist institutions like gangs is that they offer sense of belonging. I mean, if you go to a religious fundamentalist institution like an evangelical church, which I've been to, like, people are just like, thank you so much for coming. Like, we want to stay in touch. I mean, they know how to organize. And we don't have a strong secular organizing arm these days, and it's probably
Bernie Bros.
No.
I thought you'd be all over that, Trisha. I said your magic exam word.
Well, I believe...
You're not going to take the bait?
No bait. I think that Jason, you have a really good point. I mean, I think that there is... I think maybe underlying all of this is that people are in search of community, right? And their community is a community built on exclusivity or exclusion. You know, it could be one of the, it could be unifying. It could be like, hey, come one, come all. But the tendency is often to say, you don't belong and we belong together. So if we can create secular spaces where that happens and it's not a bar, I mean, maybe that could lighten the load a little bit. I could see that. Because actually, aren't most of our social sort of gatherings built around churches in some ways, or some sort of religious activity?
I think when we talk about families, I think families have to resort to religious organizations to organize if they want to interact with other families. Or, I know in New York City, a lot of people socialize with the family
sports.
Socialize through sports, but also whoever your kids go to school with.
Right. And it's worth noting, I think that, and you see this again in North Carolina, in cities there's much less of this need to go to religious fundamentalism, because there are a lot of organizations, people are around each other. I mean, New York City, people organize around all kinds of things, right?
Oh, anything.
You've got all kinds of associations, but I think people who live in places that are more isolated from each other, I think you see. I mean, I'm struck by, you know, in Europe, you keep hearing about how, you know, young Muslim men who become radicalized, they're on the fringe of society, they are unemployed, there's no one there to embrace them other than some radical, you know, Muslim leader or movement. And I, you know, it's maybe not as extreme here, but I think it's the same underlying need, that need sense of belonging, and it's harder to find if you're not in a big city like New York, where, you know, there are flyers up every block of like some other group you can join.
Well, honestly, I just think these people are fucking hateful, and I think what you need to admit to is your own damn loneliness and your own fear and your own fear of death, and just
well, that's why you choose religion in the first place, Trish.
That's right. I mean, that's right.
Yeah, but you know what? Just cry about it. Admit the fact that you absolutely have no idea what comes after this.
And stop trying to keep people out of your fucking bathroom.
I know. I mean, essentially, but you know, the end game, I hear when I was reading up a little bit about the laws, is that essentially trans people have decided just to not go in public bathrooms. So they've essentially terrorized trans people. So that now they're even more isolated in their homes. So don't go out into a public space, which I guess was the end aim of the laws anyway. The whole thing is unpleasant.
And the fact that
people can't see that this is like a long trajectory from when, I mean, obviously if I say something about race, people are going to go, well, we didn't choose to be black. But it really is a civil rights issue. You need to just check yourself and leave people alone. And if really you are about God, God's watching, and I'm sure he's capable of policing just fine.
Yes.
But this has nothing to do with him. So the whole thing is enraging, to be honest. Just admit your own vulnerability.
This is what I was saying. Just put it out there, and then once it's out there, you deal with it. But, you know, to wrap this up, I think the U.S. government's going to go after them. And
it'll be interesting.
20 years from now, this is going
to
be super embarrassing for everybody. It's going to be Jim Crow is super embarrassing to us now, or that segregation was. It's going to seem so super embarrassing, but we'll have to carry this shame with us as Americans into the next generation. But there it is.
All right.
It sounds exciting.
You know what's great? So I start off with my depressing anecdote of suburban decay, and then we followed up with this super depressing HB2 bathroom bill. So Jason, what depressing topic do you have for us tonight? That's the topic. So our second sponsor this week is depression.
That's the first sponsor.
Get it? We have it apparently, and yeah. Jason, take it away.
Actually, I think there is a segue to be had here, which is I'm actually going to introduce a religious topic as a possible remedy. As a possible remedy.
I love it.
I'm not interested.
I doubt. Oh gosh, you've gotten so anti. Let's
be open-minded, Chris.
Don't throw that at me. I'm very open-minded.
Are you sure?
Well, let's find out, Jason.
Let's find out. Okay. So, you know, I've heard people make arguments for why capitalism has the potential to be, you know, kind of the most equitable, approach to economics. And the fact that there's equal opportunity, you know, capitalism, of course, was a reaction to a feudal system where you were just born into a caste, and capitalism opened up the opportunity that you can actually, you know, move up. You can achieve upward mobility. You can earn capital. And I think the challenge, though, is that the fact that property gets passed down generation to generation makes it really hard for mobility to ever happen on a large scale. Certainly, it happens on a small scale all the time. But so, you know, and then there are people who are religious Christians that somehow see capitalism as, you know, coinciding with Christianity, which I never understood because the New Testament's quite clear that Jesus and his disciples held all their goods in common. But anyway, but what I wanted to bring up, though, is in the Torah, in the, you know, books of Moses, there's this concept of the Jubilee, and basically, it says every 49 or 50 years, there's debate about which one it is, all debts are forgiven, and basically everyone ends up back on an equal playing field. And the question I want to pose to you is, if in our country, in our brand of capitalism, if every 50 years all debts were forgiven and everyone basically starts back on an equal playing field, is it possible that capitalism here could actually be equitable, and children who, you know, our family who is not wealthy, you know, in this 50 years, and the next 50 years may actually have a shot at it. Whereas right now they have very little shot if they're not already starting out with a lot of capital.
So, question, does Jubilee actually happen?
Well,
practically?
There's a lot of debate about historically whether it ever meant anything, but the idea was that in the land of Israel, God, it came from God. God said to them, every 49 or 50 years, part of it was you need to free all your slaves because, you know, slavery was widespread then, and you got to send them back to where, you know, to where they were from, and then, and you have to forgive all debts. And again, it's debated whether it actually happened, but if you read it, it could have happened. I mean, there's no reason why the Israelites couldn't have lived like that in the land of Israel.
Okay, I don't want to shoot this topic through the spine.
But
without any historical data that this actually happened, could this not just be another moral tale from the Bible, a fable without any sort of practical...
What I want you to respond to is, I realize that this is unlikely to ever happen.
I mean, as unlikely as the Red Sea being parted. Do you see where I'm going with this? Like, this is a tale from the Bible.
That happened. Anyway.
Oh, Lord. If that's where we're starting, I'm out.
What I'm challenging us to do is forget about historically. If we were to actually institute that in a capitalist system, would that be more equitable? I mean, a part of what's at the root of my question is, you know, I've gone back and forth about capitalism versus socialism, and like, to me, at the heart of both,
those aren't the only options.
Okay, why don't you want to talk about that?
No, I don't want to talk about that because I'm not a hardcore economist. I reject the idea of these sort of dichotomies when it comes to economies. I know that doesn't exist.
Okay, well, let me say it like this then. The problem with any economic system is self-interest. We are all hardwired to pursue what we perceive to be in our own self-interest. And the problem with that is some people are equipped naturally, genetically, socially, from their family, to pursue their self-interest much more effectively than others. And so you always end up with inequity. There's kind of no getting around that. Some people are born with the smarts to get ahead, the drive to get ahead. Some aren't. But if we reset every 50 years, does that make it less inequitable?
Well, you're resetting debt. That's what you're resetting, right? So in some sense, you get to reset mistakes.
Oh, I'm sorry, but also property.
So you lose your property every 50 years.
Property that you obtain from someone else goes back to them every 50 years.
Huh.
So during the 50 years, there's this exchange of goods and services and property and acquisition of things, and then it resets every 50 years.
Well, what kind of situation? Okay, so this is completely a thought experiment, right?
Yes, clearly.
Completely a thought experiment.
Yes. I'm not advocating for this bill just yet.
I'm just saying it's as wacky as an idea as Black Lantis. This is another one of the idealistic pipe dreams, but I'll entertain it. So, Jason, what you're saying is that at the end of a period of 49 years, all debts reset. They don't get wiped out. All that means is that if I had a lot of land, let's say, and I let it to you, that you're renting it or you buy it, at the end of 50 years, that land returns to me. Not
at
that
the
it gets,
new value.
At the new, land is land. We're talking about property, right?
Yeah, but it increases in value.
Or decreases.
But the point being is that I retain it. So even the selling it to you, like, and here comes all the capitalism right behind me, but even if I let it to you and you pay me for it, 50 years from now, me and my descendants are going to have the ability to sell that land again and maintain the system. So instead of any equity, any equality, what you have is a never-ending 50-year loop of the same haves and the same have-nots.
No, not the same have-nots.
Yes, you have for a period of time.
No, but the assumption is that you can build, you can take the original property and build something out of that. It's like, it's essentially like a 50-year loan, really. And what you do with that could be quite freeing. Like if you are able to transfer, if you're able to take something that you have bought from someone else and double it
and then use that as a resource to build something, and you go you give back the original property. You could have created wealth for yourself. Now, if you didn't, and everything went to hell in a handbasket, you get to reset. It's like bankruptcy.
But it's not like bankruptcy. That's exactly right.
Yeah, it's like bankruptcy.
It's like bankruptcy. You no longer owe anymore, you know, and you start over.
I mean, it's interesting because think about how many people who understand bankruptcy are presumptive GOP frontrunner.
I was just going to say, Trump loves to talk about it. He loves to go bankrupt. It's a strategy.
Yeah, and it's been very effective because what it does is it makes you less risk averse. You are willing to take all sorts of chances on businesses, knowing that on some level you're going to be able to restart. The problem, though, is that your restart timeline is really long. I would have to do this, like, I'd have to have it collapse down from 50 to maybe 15
for it to not hold
a sting. I mean, essentially, that's a generation, right? That's a generation that has to suffer.
Two generations, right,
that has to suffer for your failures, or gets to enjoy the high life if something resets. I mean, what's interesting about it is the notion that you're not trapped is maybe the potential for possibilities, right? The potential for upward mobility, which is... But you know what's interesting about this, Jason, is that most people think that the most upwardly mobile society that's available is ours.
In some ways it is, though.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's ultimately the most... I mean, it's certainly not the case in the UK.
No, I think it is, but first of all, I really appreciated your riffing on this, Trisha. I thought you had some great ideas. I think...
That was a subtle read of me, wasn't it?
No, it was just a real appreciation for Trish. But it was going.
It was both. It was 100% both, just to be clear.
Well done.
Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. No, but I think, yes, there's been a significant amount of upward mobility. I think there are two issues. One is that we kind of have a permanent underclass, which follow lines of race, but also we even have a permanent white underclass in certain parts of the country. So you've got this underclass that is so far behind economically, it's hard to see at any scale upward mobility. And then the other dynamic you have, which I'll name again, Bernie Sanders keeps tapping into, is that we have just this top 1% that has, even over the past several years, just like, it's amazing how quickly and comprehensively they have concentrated wealth in such a small group of people. So we have upward mobility, but there are caveats. And I guess that's what I'm thinking. Part of why I get inspired by this is, you know, I'm in public education. I work with a lot of African-American kids from low-income households. And while I can tell you plenty of success stories of kids who've graduated from college, it is so hard. And I'm working in Baltimore. There are 80,000 kids in the public school system. Most of them are in poverty, and it's very hard to see a path out of poverty for any significant number of them. And I just wonder whether there's some remedy, some innovation, some systemic nudge in our system that would actually open up the door to the possibility of mobility for them.
Maybe, but I think, yes, and I'm a fan of it. However, I think a heavy-handed property/asset shift, debt elimination every 15 or 50 years, I don't know if that's it. I'm struggling to understand what that would look like. It would be a completely different society than we have now. But then I'm thinking, to combat some of the things that you two have brought up, we could do some far less severe things. And sure. Yes, now I'm bringing him up, but here, this is Bernie Sanders' bread and butter, isn't it? His ideas about how to fix us economically. Have everyone go to college for free. I mean, wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't it be great if students aren't released from college with all of this debt so they can begin building wealth? And that there's your true upward mobility. If you had the same access to access, which is what college gives you. So, I mean, it's an interesting idea, Jason. And I think it's an idea that... Bernie Sanders and his ilk are running with. But it's not new, and no, it could not be instituted. Not under these current conditions. We'd have to have a real economic revolution, like a real a real tearing down of the 1% and a real looking at ourselves in the mirror, full come to Jesus mode about our relationship with capitalism. We have a permanent underclass, and so many of us are comfortable with that, because I know the three of us in this conversation, our lives are one of relative comfort. Mm-hmm. And every day I am aware that I live in relative comfort because millions of people don't.
Right.
And until we can look in the mirror and really come to terms with that, Jubilees, free college, you know, Bernie Sanders for president, all those things are just real pipe dreams. Capitalism is the root cancer of everything that you're talking about.
Well, I mean, thanks, Chris, for bringing it back to depression.
Listen, depression is one of our sponsors. They demand we give them airtime.
Well, what I was curious about, though, Jason, and I don't know if this is like a probably a total segue off of it, but I'm curious. Was there ever a time when there was a kind of public shame around extreme wealth?
France, the French Revolution.
Was that it?
They were cutting the heads off of aristocrats. Yeah.
See, but that didn't happen in this country, did it?
Well, I mean, but we've never had such extreme wealth.
Here?
Yeah, here, right?
Oh, we absolutely have. We absolutely have.
In terms of the way capital is spread out, right?
The people who signed the Constitution were, by their day, millionaires. They were extremely rich people.
But people were living off the land, so did we not conceptualize it in that way or no? I don't know. I'm trying to figure that out. Because what I'm curious about, though, is that in some way, we have to have a different relationship with money that you've talked about, Chris, in order for some of these scenarios that Jason brings up to happen. And I feel like we almost have to not want to overthrow, but I think people have to shift their feeling about making 300 times more than their lowest worker in a company. I mean, there should be some shame in that on some level, right? Or at least just an inability, a recognition that therefore that people can't then sustain a capitalist economy if they don't have money to buy things. Like either it's got to be a practical recognition or a moral one, and maybe less of a moral
because isn't practical. Well, I do think that day is coming, or maybe here, where that people don't have enough income to buy what. The 1%.
Whatever you're selling.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry, Jason. I'm not that hopeful on account of my depression, and also because I don't know why you think that day is coming, and I don't think it's here yet.
I didn't say I think it's coming. I'm asking, would that help if it came?
Yeah, would that be something where really there's just this social pressure to looking around and saying, wow, I have a lot? I'm isolated. I'm in my lovely mansion, but I guess whenever I see dystopian visions, it's always that. Very, very wealthy, moneyed people isolated because the outside world is filled with people who are rambling around in the trash and they might get you. Yeah. Isn't that always the dystopian future? Is that the wealthy money group are isolated in some space somewhere else?
Because they need a place to enjoy their money. You know?
Exactly, right? You know, without shame.
It reminds me of what we were talking about, Trisha, back when you and I were in San Francisco.
Yeah.
We were talking about gentrification and how what happened was basically downtown was abandoned to the homeless and they just moved somewhere else, right? So now the downtown area is a place where people are running around begging for money. We saw at least 3 or 4 people getting arrested, remember? Just the cops, like, rounding people up.
I mean, it was slightly dystopian in nature. I mean, when it was weird because I kept thinking to myself, how did we psychologically as a culture get to a place where it was okay for me to walk down the street and see this and be incapable of doing anything
about it. And not run to government buildings and demand that.
Yes.
You know?
Or
we
run
were just
away.
Strolling around. Yeah, we were just walking around being like, wow, this is so weird and dirty. Then we got on a plane and we flew out. You know? But that's it. That's it. But that's the come to Jesus moment that we have to have. We have to be able to look at these things and be like, why aren't we up in arms about it? But there's reasons why we're up in arms, because we're comfortable.
Well, no, it's not that I'm comfortable. I think part of it for me is that I don't see a path to change. I might need a path. I might need some help seeing what that looks like. Is it sort of, maybe if I'm looking at it within sort of the political system, then I'm voting for someone on a very basic level, then I'm working on it at the city, district, state, federal, blah, 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 and moving it all the way up. I'm looking at someone who looks around and says, this is horrendous. So in some ways, Jason's scenario begs the question of, like, who would raise this in some way for us to actually move on it?
Well, I guess the question, what I do want to ask that builds on that question is, because this term comes from a Hebrew word in the Bible, can we get all the religious people organized around it?
No.
What? Not that part of the Bible.
You love the Bible. Let's do it.
They'd rather organize around bathroom laws.
No, they'd rather organize around like two sentences in Leviticus and just ignore everything.
Crazy. He doesn't talk about transgender people in the Bible.
They don't talk about a lot of things that evangelical Christians are concerned about.
So you're trying to figure out means of distribution of wealth. Every single conversation with Jason comes back to distribution of wealth. This time around, his solution was forgiving your debt every 50 years. I'm not opposed to it. I'd like to get rid of the Sally Mae debt.
There it is, self-interest.
I don't
do it.
Sure, why not?
I'd have to think about it. You know, economics for me is always my blind spot. I have to sit in a very quiet room and stare at the wall for like a good 2 or 3 hours before I can understand like the base concepts. So I'll think about this, but I don't think that this really attacks the problem that you're talking about. I think it institutes a new kind of economy that I feel like would end up, I feel like we just do the same thing we're doing now, but in miniature. Like on a loop, I don't know. But I have to think about it.
See,
I do think, but I think it's the idea of like debt in general.
Yeah.
It's not about clearing your debt every 50 years. The fact that we have this relationship with debt and it plays a central role in our lives, in all of our lives, I mean, that's the concept that needs to be exploded.
Wow. You sound just like Paul Ryan.
Oh my God!
That was almost verbatim.
Wait! What do you mean?
Paul Ryan say that?
No, what does
you
that
know,
mean?
He's all about the debt. We got to get the national debt. Like we got to stop being addicted to debt. Medicaid and Medicare are not sustainable, and we should stop going into debt to sustain them.
Everyone, hold on. I didn't go that far.
I'm half joking, but
I know.
I agree with you.
Talking on a theoretical root level. He's talking on a different, on a practical, balanced budget level. I'm just saying, like, we have to, and I feel like I'm about to start saying some communist shit right now, but I feel like we have to think about the basics, and we have to think about how to deliver it to people in a way that doesn't involve profit margins and self-interest of large corporations. And when it comes to things like clean water, energy, healthcare, food, security, and education, like we have to deliver those things without profit motives.
And then the rest of the time you can play.
Yeah. And then everything else, I think if we started there, things would trickle down. And then,
Trickle?
Oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't say
that. Now you're Reagan.
I know.
Ryan,
I'm all over the place.
You're Reagan.
I know. And in between there, I was like almost Marxist, and then I was Leninist, and now I've come down to Reagan. I told you.
You are confused by economics. Yeah.
I am confused by economics.
Because you're going to be like, I think we need a serfdom in the United States.
But I mean, in my head, as I'm thinking about this, like I am describing and I am cozying up with communist ideas in my head, because that's what I'm thinking, is that there has to be some control of the state who is not concerned about debt and that sort of thing. They have to just deliver these services, and that's, I don't know how that can happen here. So Jason, take us home on this. So we had the conversation. Did you arrive anywhere new? Did you hear anything that were you surprised by? Do you feel any more enlightened?
I like what Tricia was saying, and I actually think what you were saying, Tricia, about, it's almost like a loan. You get a certain amount of capital, you grow it, you get to keep what's left. Like, that kind of is the ideal, I think, of capitalism, right? Like, even what you were saying, Chris, about debt, I mean, the thing, I think what capitalism is supposed to do is say someone who has resources lend some of them to someone else in a way that both meets their self-interest, but then also helps someone else get ahead. Like, that's what, that's the idealistic side of capitalism. That's what should happen. And I think putting our last two conversations together, I think maybe what I want to make my mission in life is organizing Christian evangelicals around around social justice to get them to stop worrying about who's in the bathroom and get them actually helping to redistribute.
Please no longer invite me to any of your parties. I'm not lying. That sounds like a nightmare.
I'm the perfect candidate to organize the evangelical Christians. Yeah, I just see myself as.
Go for it.
I absolutely see a Jew from New Jersey. Hey, everyone. Hey, Christian evangelicals.
Hey, Christians, follow me.
It'll be like Jesus coming all over again.
There you go. Much. Yeah. Follow a Jewish guy.
That should be your slogan. Hey, everyone. I'm Jason. Follow the Jewish guy.
I love that. Sponsored by Follow the Jewish guy.
Yeah, and moving on.
I approve this message.
Well, who knows? By the time we record again, maybe capitalism would have completely fallen and we're living in some sort of weird communist future. We can only hope. But anyway, Tricia, what's your topic?
Oh, my topic is very light, I think. And maybe
you always say that. Listen, first of all, this has been a very dark and depressing podcast. We know it. You know it. You know, you're crying in a corner, so are we.
You also always say, like, I think it's going to be really short, and then we talk about it forever.
Yeah. Or, like, you're like, this is really light and simple, and then by the time we lay out all the complexities, we're sweaty and exhausted.
So, this is a continuation of something that I said at the end of the last podcast. Now, I gave a recommendation about a podcast that I was listening to that featured Michael Sam. And I was thinking about how dismissive I was of Michael Sam. And I don't like to do that. I felt it was somewhat unfair. But I started to contemplate the role of people like Michael Sam and Caitlyn Jenner, which is they are occupying two roles, right? They're on a personal journey, which they must be allowed to continue as best as possible. Yet, they're also symbolic and emblematic of larger issues. And because of that, I feel like they have a responsibility to educate themselves about the issues because they have become spokespeople, unintentionally. They've become spokespeople. So every time I hear the two of them speak about an issue that relates to gay rights or trans rights or a number of things, I'm very disappointed because I think to myself, you need to get yourself a refresher course on LGBTQ history. And you need to really understand the landscape and be able to place yourself in the context of the landscape so you can still have your own individual truth in your individual story, but then always reflect back on what's going on for the larger community. Is that a reasonable expectation that we should have of those people? Or is that wholly unfair?
Well, I think there is a distinction to be drawn. I have to admit, I'm not super knowledgeable about either of the people that you've mentioned, but my sense is that Caitlyn Jenner has stood up and said, film me, you know, photograph me, write about me, I will do tons of interviews, you know, and has just been very forthcoming. And I feel like Caitlyn Jenner has said, you know, I am going to be a spokesperson. So, therefore, I think it's probably fair, you know, to be critical and to have expectations of Caitlyn Jenner. I think Michael Sam, it's different because while he publicly, you know, announced his sexual orientation, I mean, most of what he does is he's doing his thing, right? Like, he's...
Well, he was aiming to be the first out football player. That's not something that he – I mean, that's a personal journey for him, but it was clearly something that had an agenda as well. Like, he wanted to be the first gay football player that was out.
Wait, let me just it's what you're saying, strictly speaking, is correct. But really, Michael Sam wanted to be a professional football player, and he's gay.
No,
hold on a second.
No,
did he get into football knowing that he was gay and being like, because that's really different from what this Caitlyn Jenner.
Let me just finish.
Okay. I think I agree with what Jason is saying. Caitlyn Jenner put herself out there and was like, "Listen up, everybody. I have a story to tell, and I am a trans person," and really took the bull by the horns. Michael Sam is a young man who had dreams of being a football player, and he's gay. And as part of his journey, yes, he would be the first out gay football player, but he wanted to be a football player. And I think that's an important distinction, because he didn't sign up to be gay, one, but he wants to be a football player. Like, he's self-interested in that, and that sort of undercuts his... It sort of undercuts the wrong word. That sort
supersedes.
Yeah, it kind of supersedes his role as a spokesperson. Caitlyn Jenner wants that mantle. Michael Sam wants to advance his career.
I'm sorry I was interrupting you, but the reason why I was interrupting you is because he explicitly said he wanted to be a gay football player because he didn't have to come out. He chose to come out. And so that, you know, it's one thing because it's, because that's one of the things that comes up in the interview for him, which is intriguing. He said in the interview that if he had thought better of his advisors around him, it might have been wiser for him to simply have been recruited on a team purely as a football player and then come out. So he's sort of internalizing the challenge of being a gay football player. He really has put them together. Because his record as a football player, just as a football player, with any sort of sexual orientation question, stood on its own and would have necessitated that he be chosen as like a first-round draft pick or something like that. He was that good. So he feels like by choosing to out himself before getting picked, he did damage to that ability to just be a football player. So he's not that person who just wanted to be a football player. He was deliberate in saying, I'm going to be a gay football player. You know, I'm going to be out. Because he's also met many football players who he says have come up to him later, and they are closeted. So they were like, good on you for trying to do that road. Do you see?
I see what you're saying. I think I was thrown by putting him and Caitlyn Jenner.
Yeah.
Because I think they are really differently situated.
They are.
Because Michael Sands at the beginning of his career, Caitlyn Jenner's at the end of her career, you know, because they're both in sports, right? And also Caitlyn Jenner, like Jason said, has been very goal-directed and self-interested, actually, right? Very goal-directed.
Well, I mean, Caitlyn Jenner's career right now is being the public trans spokesperson, right?
There's except no she other career. So poorly. Except she does it so poorly.
Well, I mean...
That's the problem. And so, but, you know, I mean, what I'm saying is I just gave Caitlyn Jenner and Michael Sam, but you two could easily come up with others who have been tossed in an arena that's purely based on something that's happened to that person. And what I'm saying is that when that happens, I think there needs to be some self-reflection that, well, I'm no longer speaking as myself anymore in the room. And I mean, that's a heavy burden, but I feel like if you have that mantle, it behooves you to do a little bit of reading.
But first of all, yes, absolutely. I can't disagree with you there. But I don't know how we communicate that to people, like who are struggling with things and who maybe perhaps are already in the public eye. Let's look at Kesha and everything she went through with Dr. Luke, and she was sexually assaulted by him and was forced to work with him and all these other things. Like now she is seen as someone who speaks out for women who have been sexually assaulted or sexually abused. Now, I followed the story, but I didn't follow it closely enough to know if this is something that Kesha welcomes. Does she embrace that? I don't know. But Kesha is a famous person who was sexually abused, and now she's ushered into rooms to talk about it. Like, so Trisha, what are you saying? Like, yes, she should be self-reflective. Yes, she should meet with other sexual abuse victims. I mean, if she wants to, but what's her responsibility here? Should she stop being famous?
No, like, her. You know what I mean? I think her responsibility is that when you go into a room now and you are, every time I hear someone that has been placed in a position like that, I wince because it's not just you anymore. And so
but there's no good way to navigate it, which is what I'm
I want to ask you, Tricia, an authentic question. Is there anyone in the role you're describing that you feel like does a good job?
Well, not anyone that currently is alive, but I thought when Arthur Ashe found himself in a situation around AIDS and HIV, which was not of his own doing, that it was all through surgery, that he educated himself and proceeded to talk about it in a way that was meant to destigmatize it. And Ryan White's parents did that. I think that that's what I mean. I think that when something happens to you, and you can, your struggle is always there, and that's, I'm always going to appreciate your own personal struggle. But somebody like, say, for example, Kesha, I mean, that's a horrible situation for Kesha. But now, if she's been placed in an interview context, and it's not just about her, and they want her to riff on other things, then I really think that she should sit down with like a sexual abuse advisor to then give some context. Like for her to say, you know, this is my personal story, but I just want to let you know that when this happens, it happens mostly to people who are blah, 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 blah. You know, just to sort of round those topics out, because you're going to have a platform suddenly. And I just feel like it's not okay for you to go into the room and be asked to talk about being a gay athlete and for you to only stay on a personal level. I think you need to blow those things out a little bit.
I agree, but then it gets so murky. It gets so murky because it's like, Kesha, let's go back to Kesha, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why she's easier to conceptualize in because she's of the moment right now.
Yeah.
But Kesha, also because there was an event, something that happened to her which changed her life, at least when we knew about it, right?
Yeah.
The thing about Kesha is that Kesha is a famous person who this very private, this private violation happened to, made public because she is a famous person. Uh-huh. Now, of course, because she's famous, other people are going to write her and respond to her and feel some sort of kinship with her, placing a responsibility onto her, perhaps, that she did not ask for. Now Kesha is on the red carpet, she's at the Grammys or whatever, and people ask her about her own journey, but in asking about it, they may say something like, well, what do you have to say to sexual abuse victims out there? Sure. And now suddenly she's in a spotlight she didn't ask for. So what are her choices really? So one, she can get a counselor, an advisor, who could sort of like feed her the right things to say, or at least educate her. But why is that her burden now, when she has to deal with the event that actually happened to her? I mean,
that's life.
I mean, that's the price of fame. I guess that's what it comes down to. You know, you got big dreams. You know what I mean? Like, this is where you start paying.
Well, I mean, it's just what happens. I mean, I guess, I don't know. I guess it's just, I'm not going to judge the person harshly. I mean, that's not what I'm saying.
No, and I want to also say that.
Yeah, that's not.
I'm not judging anybody for the choices they make around any trauma or identity issues or sharing it. I'm not
at all. However,
Jason is, though. I can tell by his silence that he didn't jump in on that, that he's being extremely judgmental.
Silently judging all of them.
Disgusting. Anyway, Tricia, go on.
Be punished.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm just going to wrap this down by just saying, I just think that when things happen to you, I often think well of the person who is able to see both themselves and the other and address the other too. Like we are in this space together, and this is unique to me, and I'm going to tell you what happened to me, but then here's another thing I can point out to you. Because then it just becomes, it just becomes a sort of a space for you to recognize other people's struggles, both in what's common to between the two of you and what isn't. And so
you can only hope that really traumatic things happen to very famous and very mindful people, right? Because I mean, then you have the Alec Baldwins of the world,
yes,
who are complete assholes, and then because they're assholes and they're punished for it from their children and their ex-wives and the court, they want to now say, well, I'm now a spokesperson for men's rights. Men don't have enough. And sort of like, well, actually, no, you fuck. Like, you're a terrible person. It's like, so, but he's not mindful, but he has a platform.
He does, and he could say to himself, he could say, you know what, but I'm really unique. I'm in a unique situation because I have money, I have resources.
If he was mindful, yeah.
If he was mindful, right? He could also say other men who are in similar situations but don't have the resources but want to see their kids. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a whole way to do it.
I think I would just frame it slightly differently what? From how you framed it, Tricia, just in terms of when someone who's famous has, you know, undergone trauma or identity challenges or whatever, acceptance challenges that a lot of other people who aren't famous have gone through, there's an opportunity for them to be mindful and be spokespeople. I'm hesitant to say they have a responsibility just because, I mean, I may feel that way, but like it's kind of like, who the hell am I to tell them what their responsibility is?
We tell other people.
You and Chris tell other people. I don't tell them.
Oh, Lord. Don't claim the high ground, Jason. You've been rolling around the muck with us for almost 20 years.
Whatever.
Stop it.
It's impossible because Jason's always imagining scenarios of perfection, so definitely involves telling other people.
I mean, everything with famous people, it's really hard to determine. Like, you can't really heap responsibility on them. It's just... I mean, doesn't Don Lemon have a responsibility not to be a black gay asshole? But I'm stuck with him. You know what I mean?
Well, I don't. But, you know, Don Lemon is just going about getting his money. I'm talking about people who then essentially ascend to a role of spokesperson for a cause that they didn't pick, but it just happens. So it's not simply celebrity, though. I think I must be clear about that, that I'm not just talking about any celebrity where bad things happen. I talk about any celebrity who then gets tagged as a spokesperson. I think when that happens, you have unintentionally inherited something that's probably better suited for someone who spent many years studying it and seeing it on the ground. And if you don't know it, I would rather you just always place things within the context of your story only. Mm-hmm. And say, I can only speak from this, but please do not do a disservice to other stuffers by proclaiming your tale. Because sometimes I find Caitlyn Jenner to be slightly unsympathetic as a trans person.
Oh,
and that's bothersome to me because I think trans issues are really important. And because she's ended up as a spokesperson in some ways by default because of her previous fame, that really is a challenge to me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where that really came from.
So there it is. I agree. So we're moving into recommendations, which is a media event, something that you saw, heard, experienced, you think other people should see, hear, or experience, or an anti-recommendation, something you experienced that you think people should avoid. Tricia?
Well, I shared it with you, and I'm going to share it with others. So... I think we might have dismissively talked about this woman on our podcast and say we're going to have to dig deeper on about her. Bell Hooks. I will invite you to go to bellhooksinstitute.com and read Bell Hooks' article on Beyoncé's Lemonade. The reason why I like this article is because it is out of step with the general feeling about Lemonade. I think the article has some positive feelings about Lemonade, but I also think it's quite critical of Lemonade. And so I always appreciate that. When everyone is looking and going one way, I sometimes like to see someone who asks me to think about a different point of view. Bell Hooks has, of course, called Beyoncé a terrorist in the past. So just a heads up.
Parental guidance is suggested.
It will not be your your best friend's take on Lemonade, but I still think it's worthy of reading, and I would love to hear what people think about it. That's what I read.
Bell Zero Chill Hooks.
She has no chill.
I still want to talk about her article. Madonna, Soul Sister or Plantation Mistress?
That's it. I mean, Bell Hooks is like a
she doesn't even give a shit. she's calling everybody out.
So
that article is really good, by the way.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Jason,
I am going to share something that was shared with me by our friend Rosenny, who...
Ooh.
Hi, Rosenny.
Yeah, you can say hi. She has not listened to the podcast once and doesn't seem interested in ever doing so.
Wow.
So.
And you know what's terrible? We're friends. All three of us are really good friends
with
her.
That's what I said. I said, three of us. Like, what are you talking about? If anyone should be listening, you should. Anyway, maybe I'll tell her I mentioned this and maybe she'll listen. Probably not, maybe. Though. But anyway, she shared with me this movement called Abraham. And it's a couple, Esther and Jerry Hicks, who... the Abraham Hicks website that, and what I do, which is, this is what Rosenny suggested, is I'll just YouTube, search on YouTube for like Abraham Hicks, and then like whatever spiritual topic I'm interested in hearing about, physical well-being, financial well-being, general well-being, love, and there are these like 15-minute meditations. I find them really good. Not everybody's into this kind of thing. I like this kind of thing, and it's really good. I really enjoy it.
Fabulous. She's recommended that to me too. I like your approach to getting into it, is to pick it.
It's really easy, right? Like I mean, honestly, like I'm brushing my teeth in the morning, so I'm like, oh, I'll listen to Abraham Hicks, and it's probably not the way you're supposed to do it, but I get it done.
Great. My recommendation is the excitement around John Cho on the internet.
Oh, that thing is great!
A little while back, there was a, I don't know if he was a graphic designer or something in New York City. He came up with this website, and he started a hashtag starring John Cho. And what he wanted to do was push back on the idea that you had to have white male leads in movies in order to make them work. And he's like, well, why not Cho? And so he has reimagined all these films like... Matt Damon in The Martian, or the James Bond movie Spectre, and he photoshops John Cho into the poster of the film, just showing you like, well, this is what it would look like if you had an Asian leading man. And I think the idea was like, if you look at this and you think it looks funny or odd, well, then that's really the problem, and we should discuss it. And I kind of like that sort of.
That sounds cool.
Digital.
It's clever.
Yeah, that I like that sort of like digital revolution of just sticking John Cho into things. And I'm sure John Cho loves it too, because John Cho is having a moment.
Can I tell you, though, immediately upon seeing the image of John Cho for The Martian, I would have seen that movie. I didn't see the other one, because who wants to see Matt Damon? But I feel like we spent movies saving Matt Damon. But it would have been really fun to see someone try to save John Cho.
I don't understand the problem we're solving for. We've had Bruce Lee and Jackie Chan. We don't have Asian leads? What are we talking about?
You're right.
I've seen like hundreds of movies with Asian leads. They're all kung fu movies, but come on.
I know.
Jason. I know you're joking. You know what I mean? I hope everyone who's listening, mouths are agape right now at what you just said.
Well, he's got the perfect response. This is how other people respond to something.
Not me. All right. All right, my lovelies. Have a great night. Night.
Bye.
Goodbye.